From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour will be made throughout the year 2019, which the United Nations has declared the International Year of Indigenous Languages. As noted by the UN, the ongoing loss of indigenous languages can be devastating for cultures and can infringe upon indigenous peoples' most basic human rights. Native peoples are struggling with the endangerment of their languages, and the process by which that happened has historical roots, especially on this continent. In an effort to assimilate Native American children into white society, the U.S. and Canadian governments forced them to live in boarding schools where they weren't allowed to use their native languages. Some children were even beaten for speaking Seneca. When they grew up, these students didn't identify with their native culture or use their language. Some of the former students who did maintain it were afraid to speak it. There are many examples of languages that have become endangered or extinct. We'll talk about that this hour, and our guest will help us understand how language shifts happen and how languages can be lost. We'll also learn about efforts to revive and protect languages, some of them happening here in our own community. So welcome to our guest for the hour, and you might have heard the outstanding recent reporting from our colleague at WXXI, Caitlin White. She's in studio. Hey, thanks for coming across the hall.
Thank you very much.
Also with us in studio, Ronnie Pollock is a member of the Mississaugas of the New Credit First Nation Eagle Clan and executive director of the Native American Cultural Center, also the host of Two Canoes with Ronnie Pollock on WYSL 92.1 FM. Welcome back. Nice to have you.
Great to be here. Thank you, Evan.
Also with us is Robbie Jimerson, a PhD student at RIT and member of the Seneca Nation of Indians. Robbie, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And with us is Maya Abtakian, a professor in the Department of Linguistics at the University of Rochester. Maya, welcome back to you.
Thank you.
And also with us is Nadine Grimm, assistant professor in the Department of Linguistics and director of the Language Documentation and Description Program at the University of Rochester. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
Caitlin, I thought the piece was outstanding, and we're going to link to it so if our listeners have missed it, they ought to check that out. But what put this on your radar in the first place?
Yeah, well, originally I'm from Rochester, but before I started working at WXXI, I worked for a year at a radio station in rural Alaska on the far western coast, and it was a predominantly Native community. And so, you know, I ended up going there just for the fun of adventure and working at a radio station. But finally moving there, getting to know the community, I started to realize there's a lot more deep-seated issues with how, you know, white people and Natives interact with this whole history. And I took a couple of classes up there in the Inupiaq language, and people started telling us these stories. And fast forward to a couple months ago, I just happened to stumble upon that notebook of Inupiaq lessons and thought, there's got to be more, there's more stuff happening that's not just in Alaska, not just in this faraway place. And so I wanted to kind of look into those stories that happened here right in my hometown.
And where do you turn first when you're looking for that?
Google. And, yeah, so it wasn't really hard to find. Obviously, the two people who were featured in my piece are here. And you know, I realized the Native American community center is in Webster, and I grew up there and things like that. And so all this is happening around us.
Is there, do you, even stepping aside from your reporter work, do you find yourself kind of looking at your process of discovery in Alaska and then just kind of checking things out here? And do you think, boy, it's amazing how often we can remind ourselves as English-speaking white people that, well, the whole world speaks English. How often people say that?
Oh, absolutely.
Not realizing the possible impact of that assumption and that expectation.
Well, I think it's interesting. I mean, moving up there, like I said, I didn't expect to have this, like, whole learn about this stuff you didn't learn about in school. Mm-hmm. And it's stuff that growing up here when there's obviously, like, still very living Native cultures that I didn't know about until like 3 years ago when I happened to have moved up there. And so it was like, okay, this is something at least the least I can do is listen, take it back home with me and see if I can try and find these stories elsewhere.
Well, I want to turn to Ronnie Pollock because in Caitlin's piece, you know, you describe some things that go way beyond what I think a lot of us understand and realize. And that goes exactly to the point Caitlin just made. We're not taught this growing up. We're not taught about what happened at boarding schools or other settings where there was actual physical violence. Tell me about some of that.
Yeah, so with residential schools or boarding schools, I mean, typically what would happen is that they would come. It was really the Catholic Church in the U.S. government and Canadian government as well, too, that would go on reservations and, you know, remove the children, sometimes thousands of miles away from their home. But in this area, I mean, it was typically maybe a few hundred miles away from their home, some even, you know, less than that. But anyway, when they would get them to these residential schools, the first thing that they would do is take away any of their traditional clothing that they had, and that they would cut their hair. So they would all wear the same uniform. They would all have the same haircut. You know, everything was very systematic and kind of getting everybody to look alike. And so the main thing, too, is that they were forbidden to speak their language. And if they were caught speaking their language, there was punishment that would then ensue. So, I mean, if you can imagine, if you will, for a minute, you know, young children, I mean, I'm talking 4 or 5 years old, who are taken away from their family, from their homelands, and the only language they know how to speak. First of all, they don't know what's happening. They don't have the developmental ability yet to understand and grasp what's happening, let alone, you know, trying to communicate. And then when they do communicate, you know, there's abuse that takes place as a result. So really the residential school was a sheer attempt at cultural genocide. And I think the projected outcome was assimilation, you know, so that if they could capture all of these young Native children, you know, basically strip them of their culture and get them to assimilate into a colonized culture, be it in Canada or the U.S., then well, maybe we wouldn't have to worry about Native Americans anymore. They, you know, they would kind of be, they'll just assimilate into the rest of culture.
People like Caitlin and me kind of sharing stories about how little we're taught of that growing up. How much were you aware of that kind of history when you're growing up, Ronnie?
Well, I was very aware of it because my grandmother, she was a survivor, but I call her a thriver of residential school. She went to what we refer to as the Mush Hole in Brantford, Ontario. And, you know, I mean, when she was there, those are some of the things that were taken away from her, the language. So therefore, when she then, you know, aged out and moved on and eventually married and had her own children, it was something that she wasn't able to pass on. So largely for, you know, a few generations, especially like my parents' generation, my mom's generation, it wasn't something that was taught in the schools at the time either. And I think there was, you know, just such trauma, you know, and that intergenerational trauma that was very, very present and raw at the time that maybe they couldn't even identify as intergenerational trauma, where, I mean, it was so embedded in them not to speak the language. So therefore, you know, they didn't know it for one. But if they tried to learn it and pass it on to their children, there was just something that maybe felt very awkward about that. And to the best of my memory, too, my cousins, you know, when I would go and visit them and, you know, we were young and growing up, I really don't remember them. So for my generation, I don't remember them having language taught in school.
Did you hear it at all growing up?
Nope.
Didn't hear it.
No. But now I can say, you know, we've come full circle, thankfully. And, you know, this is definitely something that is steeped in the schools now on Mississauga of the Credit First Nation and also on Six Nations Indian Reserve. And largely, you know, a lot of the reservations in Haudenosaunee land, you know, there's language revitalization that's happening on the territories within the schools, because we recognize that, you know, language revitalization is key because there's so much of our culture that is embedded in our language. And, you know, we know that once you lose the language, you lose the culture. So key to.
I thought, you know, so much of Caitlin's piece, you know, not only was teaching us about this history, but also showing us the process. And we're going to talk to Robbie Jimerson in a moment about some of that work that is being done and what it's like when you just sit down and try to work through and all the different variations. I think the word was play in the piece, in Caitlin's piece, and all the different variations and how it's said and how to write it. We're going to get back to that in just a second. But I want to make sure we kind of put a finer point on Ronnie's, you know, kind of describing what happened as a kind of a cultural genocide, an intentional stripping away of culture. and forced assimilation. And I want to turn to Maya Abtakian just a little bit for the, kind of that historical framework that this there is kind of a framework of doing so in this fashion. This is hardly kind of a standalone story when it comes to the loss of language, is it?
No, not at all. I mean, I think languages are mostly endangered because of various types. I mean, sometimes this is because of social, economic, and other kinds of pressures to give up the language. Sometimes that's more explicit, and sometimes it's more implicit by offering universal education in a language that's not the child's mother tongue, and so that if they want to go to school, they have to use this other language, which means that they're then not using their mother tongue much at all, right? So there, I think there are other ways that this can happen as well.
And how long do we have a sense for how quickly a language can be lost? I mean, Ronnie's talking about a generation or two and realizing, you know, that, wow, I haven't barely even heard the language. And it wasn't that much time that had passed. It probably can happen quickly.
Right. I mean, yeah? If you think about it, all it takes is a group of parents not using the language with their children before the children are not using the language with each other and they don't learn it and it's lost. It can happen in a generation.
Would you put it in that term, kind of a cultural genocide? Intentional?
Yeah. I think not everybody. Sometimes it's as explicit as abuse in schools. Sometimes it's not as obvious, but I still think that what's happening is a type of linguicide, right? I mean, you're taking something away from people.
So listeners, as we go throughout this hour here, again, it's a packed studio, and we're going to be talking about the ways to sort of preserve and reconstruct language. And I'm coming from a place of ignorance here. Our guests are kind of helping me understand, because there are probably a lot of languages or forms and variations on the language, in which I think, Caitlin, you mentioned that for many years, there wasn't always a written form, or at least not as much of a written record. Is that right?
Yeah, that's what Robbie mentioned with the Seneca language.
Is that changed enough to satisfy you as you're doing some of this work, Robbie?
Yeah, I mean, it's always a challenge because a lot of the Haudenosaunee and Radenosaunee languages, they feel they shouldn't be written down because they were passed down orally.
Cultural tradition?
Mm-hmm, yep. Mm-hmm. So I think it's only, well, on the reservation where I'm from, the Cattaraugus Reservation, I think the Seneca alphabet was only developed in the last 20 years. So even within that, there's some variations of how people write it, but it's not much. But yeah, I mean, so within the last 20 years, it's just been started to be written.
So for your PhD research, you decided to just tackle this very small, very simple subject.
Yeah.
How did you decide to do this?
I don't know. I just wanted to help out. Really, the goal of my PhD is to help develop language learning tools. And then with, you know, the way the language is spoken, I wanted to focus on the speech side of things. So, yeah, it's definitely been a challenge, but it's been fun along the way.
Okay. And, you know, you touched on it in the conversation with Caitlin about the way that you'll just sit down with people and you'll talk about a wide range of subjects. And research in so many ways is probably just understanding how language is used, what one word may mean in different contexts. What's the biggest challenge so far in doing this?
The biggest thing is, so there's inherent challenges to doing ASR for under-resourced languages. Obviously, the first one is the fact that you don't have a lot of data to train a robust ASR system. And then within that, our languages are polysynthetic. So there's a lot happening within the word itself. So there's a great variation. So the fact that you don't have a lot of data is further compounded by the fact that there's a great variation across it. But I mean, I think that's what makes our language so beautiful. Everything's contextual. You know, you can say things all kinds of different ways. But yeah, as far as the data collection, that's really... that aspect is probably been one of the most fun parts of my PhD research. As far as collecting data, I just go sit down with other speakers and I just put a recorder between us, and then we just talk in Seneca about all kinds of things, you know, gossip, the weather, you know, what it was like as kids, what's on Facebook, right? So, yeah, it's just free-flowing, and it's a lot of fun, and the hours just melt away.
How much do you remember hearing the language growing up yourself?
All four of my grandparents at one point in their life spoke Seneca. you know, it was mentioned the residential boarding schools. So on my reservation, there was a there was one as well. It was called the Thomas Indian School, and my dad went to it. My dad and his brother. So just one generation up from me. So in the 1950s, I think, is when it closed. So that really wasn't too long ago. But yeah, I mean, my great uncle, I remember my grandpa's brother, he didn't speak English till he went to that school, but I was visiting one time, and he matter-of-factly just told me, you know, yeah, you know, I was taken behind the shed and, you know, beaten for speaking Seneca. Like his buddy asked him for a pencil or something, and he answered him back in Seneca and got caught. But yeah, so I've been exposed to a little more than some people. You know, I heard it around my grandparents' house. My grandfather's house, I spent a lot of time at. Just that was a place where my family would go, and then a lot of his friends would stop by, or he'd be talking on the phone with his brother. So I heard it a little bit when I was younger.
What is your facility with it now?
I would consider myself a second language speaker. A lot of the visiting I do with elders is just all in Seneca. So.
But do you sit down and say, wait, now slow down or do this again? I mean, do you find yourself doing that often, or are you pretty comfortable with it?
I'm pretty comfortable with it, but mm-hmm. I mean, there's just, you know, a million ways to say certain things, and I'm always like, oh, that, you know, that's so beautiful the way you said that, and I'll ask him, like, can you say that again, or, you know, I'll be like, oh, I like how you said that, or I'll even be, you know, how did you use that word right there? Just because, you know, if there's different dialects and even family dialects, and just the way they use certain words is really interesting, so...
And there are certain words or phrases that don't always translate all that well, for example, to English, yeah?
Yeah, there's quite a bit, really. And you know, to kind of, if I were to have to convey a meaning to you, I might have to tell a whole story about it and then be like, okay, and that's how you felt right there. Or, you know what I mean? Or that's when you would use that word. But if you asked me to put it in English, it'd kind of be like, well, it's kind of like this, but not really. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's a challenge sometimes.
Are there words or phrases? You mentioned play and the variations on the word play in the piece with Caitlin. I'm going to ask you to kind of, can you find another that stand out as either something that has a lot of different variations, maybe contextually, or even words or phrases that don't immediately translate? I mean, you can feel free to tell a story. We've got the whole hour here.
Yeah. Geez, you put me on the spot. But yeah, I mean, I think the play one is a really good one, because again, you know, there's you know, I could play, I will continue to play.
How do you say those words and phrases?
Oh, so like last night I played is ogat ganye, sunday ogat ganye ne dewanyo. Like last night I played lacrosse. Aunt ganye ne yohen ne heawak. So my son will play tomorrow. So there's like on those two forms, right? I'm just kind of messing around. I'm just kind of changing what would be the prefix of it. But again, you know, so depending on, you know, what kind of story you're saying, you know, I could say I will continue to play lacrosse, or, you know, I'm just going to play lacrosse that one time. So it's really, you know, it all falls into the context of the story.
Are there consistent rules on I, you, we that are pretty easily applicable?
Yeah, there's rules, but there's always, you know, there's always exceptions to the rules, obviously, and really... you know, it's really a language that can be changed in a way that for you to really get your point across. So I think it's been hard for linguists to really tack down, okay, this is how it works. You know, there's basic rules to it, but I mean, when you talk with a good speaker, like all those rules just go out the window, and it's just beautiful language.
Is it more beautiful than English?
By far, it is.
Most languages kind of are, though,
yeah.
To be fair.
And I remember one of the fluent speakers that we had, I remember she told me, she was like, English is just such a dead cold language.
See, I'm a big fan of English, and I'm a big fan of using the language in many different ways, but I just hearing you speak, Seneca, and hearing native speakers, it does have sort of lyricism to it. That's really beautiful. But in terms of the functionality of your work, what comes out of this? What's the end goal for you here?
Yeah, the end goal is really just to, you know, build language learning tools, whether it be, you know, someone speaking into a microphone, helping with their pronunciation, you know, helping, you know, one of the great things with deep learning algorithms is it kind of helps you understand a relationship. So, you know, kind of throwing the data that I have in some of these deep learning algorithms, it's kind of shown a relationship between the words. And then I think, you know, it's kind of helped us to develop curriculums for some of the immersion programs going on. And it's you know, I like to think it'll help us develop a more efficient way to teach our languages.
Do you know offhand, Robbie, would you be able to guess how many different indigenous languages there are in this country that, you know, either spoken or at risk here? I mean, it's a huge number, isn't it?
I don't know if you could count them. The one statistic that I saw that really hits home, and it was an older one too, and it said I think every 2 weeks a language dies.
And so with a lot of these individual languages, there's probably not a large population of fully fluent speakers, I guess, however we would describe that. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's definitely one of the challenges, yep.
Okay, and Ronnie, do you think we're at a point now where, you know, we've passed that point of the actual sort of eradication, the efforts to eradicate, to the point where many of these languages are salvageable? I mean, do you feel like there is a movement back in that direction?
Yeah, I really do. Again, I mean, language revitalization is so key in any of, you know, the Haudenosaunee communities. But I think across the spectrum, you know, across Turtle Island, you know, it's important to all nations. As far as numbers are concerned, I do have a few numbers that I was able to find. And I remember when I first started looking at these, and I think I just kind of stumbled upon them a few years ago. But when I saw the numbers and I saw them dwindling, it just, you know, I mean, totally, you know, squelched my heart, like, oh my gosh. And maybe Robbie, he might be able to have a little better sense on some of these numbers too. And so feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, but I know these numbers are a little bit older, but as far as the Haudenosaunee languages, Mohawk typically has the largest number for first language speakers. And that number runs around 3,300 currently. Then we go down to Oneida, and those numbers, again, for first language speakers, runs about 250. So that's a huge, huge drop. Then Onondaga language, again, to the best of my knowledge, anywhere between 50 and 100 currently. Then we go down to Cayuga, between 40 and 60. First language speakers who are still surviving. I mean, so that's one generation. I mean, that could be 10 years, you know? And
wow.
And Seneca, 175, as far as first language speakers are concerned. Yeah. So those are, you know, earth-shattering kind of numbers. Yeah, yeah.
Does technology help you, Robbie?
I hope it does. Otherwise, I'm wasting my time, right? yeah, I mean, I think it can. I mean, I'm really an optimist on this. But yeah, there's a lot of, again, between the Haudenosaunee and the Haudenosaunee community, there's a lot of revitalization efforts. And it is, you mentioned those numbers, and the same thing happens to me when I hear it. It's just, you know, it kind of hurts. But yeah, I mean, it's really inspiring when you go to a lot of the communities and you see all the efforts going on.
I think to be more specific on the technology question, I ask because do you find at least more of a receptivity to transcribing, to writing down, to using technology versus the oral traditions that you described?
Yeah, so even, you know, being born and raised and still living on the res, there was still some hesitation from people to work with me just because, you know, in some of our communities, some people feel that the linguists that had come in didn't always, you know, do it for the right reasons or take the most care with our languages. I mean, these are things that we're really stingy with and cherish. You know, so there was some apprehension to help me even, you know what I mean, with, you know, family members and, you know, what are you going to do with that? And, you know, what are you planning to do with it? But I mean, I think, you know, like a lot of things, just the more people understand and the more they learn about it, you know, I hope they realize I'm, you know, trying to do this for the right reasons and, you know, just to really help with the preservation and revitalization effort. So it's definitely gotten a lot easier.
And there are classes at
the Native American Cultural Center. Yes, we currently have Mohawk class on Thursday and Sunday evenings. It runs from 6 to 7:30. We're at 229 Empire Boulevard. And we would love to have a Seneca class. And so it's kind of what we're setting our sights on, you know, as far as a goal is concerned in, you know, capturing some grants out there that are available specific to language revitalization, because we are on Seneca land. So we'd really like to be offering the Seneca language as well.
Is the center online running?
Yes, it is. Yep. Yep, so, Native American Cultural Center, Inc.com.
So, yeah. Caitlin White, from the time that you Googled when you sat down and started this to now, what has maybe surprised you most? I mean, it's always a process of discovery for a reporter, too. What has, you know, what's the takeaway here that you want to make sure your listeners had from this story?
I mean, I think for me, the experience I had when I first moved to Alaska and got all this information just kind of thrown at me, I was almost like, not to make it about myself, but like mad at just like, why haven't I heard of this before? And why is it taking me traveling 4,000 miles away to, you know, a very rural place to finally encounter people who are, you know, dealing with these traumas and trying to rebuild these languages and stuff? And so I think, you know, like I said, the least I could do is listen and bring that back. And I think it's something that most people do think is happening in a faraway place. Like, oh, that's happening on reservations and in communities like Alaska, which seems like so distant. But it's happening right here on Empire Boulevard and at RAT and all around us. And so I think that's something that, you know, this is something that still people are processing and going through. And I also, the difference between you guys doing the class, just talking and hanging out with people, and then you doing the, Robbie, the technology side, is just showing how, you know, these things are still current and happening and changing and growing in order to make this stuff continue.
Well, in our second half hour, we're going to talk about one of the biggest archives, the Endangered Languages Archive. I want to talk to Nadine about what we see in an archive like that, and if we can even get our heads around how many languages have been fully lost, if we know when it's sort of past that point, and how that process continues. And we'll talk a little bit more about the shift, sort of language shift, and what happens when language shift is happening, not just these really overt and obviously, you know, awful ways of physically beating people for speaking anything other than a dominant language like English, but also how language shift happens. And so we'll talk to Maya and Nadine about this. And to continue the conversation based on the great reporting from Caitlin White, who's with us. So Maya Abtakian and Nadine Grimm are here from the University of Rochester, Robbie Jimerson, a PhD student at RIT and a member of the Seneca Nation of Indians, and Ronnie Pollock is here from the Mississauga's New Credit First Nation Eagle Clan and Executive Director of the Native American Cultural Center. Let's get that break and come right back on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, Lutheran minister Nadia Bolz-Weber has written a book about sex. She says for too long, Christianity has made people feel shameful about sex and about enjoying sex. Yes, within and outside of marriage. She's calling for a sexual reformation. Our panel debates it. Second hour, Congressman Joe Morelli joins us in studio. Talk with you Friday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So when it comes to languages that have been lost and an archive of endangered languages, Nadine Grimm, tell us a little bit about what exists out there now and how these archives, these records, are at least helping us understand what we have and what we are potentially could lose.
Yeah, so maybe the first thing to understand the context about the archives, why did people come up with the idea?
There you go. Grab right out of the microphone. Go ahead.
So the reason why these language archives for endangered languages came into existence in the first place is we need to understand the global state of the languages that we have today in the world. So linguists estimate that we have about 7,000 languages that are spoken around the world at the moment.
7,000?
7,000, okay. 6,000 to 7,000, depending on your counting. This goes again into the discussion. What do you count as a language? What do you count as a dialect? One major point that we also need to understand is that not all of these languages are equally distributed. So, in fact, most of the languages in the world are very tiny. And there are estimates that about 95% of the world's languages are only spoken by 6% of the world's population. So, wow. Vice versa, that means that over 90% of the world's population speak only 5% of the languages. So that you see that this is very unequally distributed. And so we have heard in the first half hour of this show the case of language endangerment in North America. I think this is a very particular case of oppression and genocide and voluntarily trying to eradicate certain cultures. But if you go into other areas of the world, the situation is quite different. So I'm specializing in African languages, for instance, and there you have countries like Nigeria, which have over 500 languages in just that country. Everybody is multilingual. Everybody speaks 5-6 languages easily. And so the endangerment situation there is quite different. So there is nobody coming in saying you need to speak this language or that language. But what happens is that parents often feel this language, this village language that we speak is of no use. Our kids will not become successful in life, so we would rather like them to speak a larger language. That is very often a colonial language, either French or English or Spanish. But very often it's also larger local African languages like Swahili, Lingala, Hausa, Yoruba. So people also shift to those languages. And this is a change that we have seen over the last 100 years as a side effect of globalization. So we are more connected in the world. We are trying to, well, we are exposed to more standardized languages. 100, 200 years ago, people in these communities would not have heard of English and would not have received any education in those languages. So this is a drastic shift that we see these days. And it's just about 30 years ago that linguists have actually realized the problem that our languages are massively dying on a scale that we have never seen before. And so linguists came up with some kind of plan to at least, well, I don't want to use the word save, but let's say preserve in a certain way as much as we can the language diversity that we find these days. And so this is getting back to your question about archives. This is how these language archives came into existence in the first place, as repository for language material on languages that are endangered. And technology helps us quite a bit with this these days. So when we think about an early example of a kind of success story about language revitalization, that would be Cornish, for instance, a language of in Cornwall that has died out in the early 19th century and that has been revived about 100 years later. But people did that on the basis of written texts. And at the time when they did the revitalization, there was no speaker of that language anymore that you could go back to and ask, is this how you say it? And of course, you face all kinds of problems. There are gaps in your data from the texts. You don't find certain sentence structures. You don't know if I want to say the sentence. How would I need to put the words? There are words missing because the dictionary, of course, is not complete. So for Cornish, it was really hard, and people had to come up with solutions how to, for instance, introduce new languages that hadn't even existed 100 years earlier before the industrialization. But these days, we're in a good position technologically wise to revitalize languages because we can actually listen to a spoken record of language. So in these language archives, the emphasis is on collecting spoken text rather than just written transcripts. So for these collections on single endangered languages, researchers and the communities try to establish a corpus on language use, meaning you ask people also, how do you greet one another when you meet in the morning or at night? How do you speak to your children? What do you say when you enter a room or when you enter a bus? What are the conventions of speech that you use? Because that's of course very different across different cultures. So it would give you a good basis for listening and seeing how people use the language in everyday life. And that is often information if you just consult grammars or dictionaries that is missing. You look at a grammar, you don't know how to tell a joke or with whom you can talk or what you say to say goodnight if you do that.
Do you think 100 years from now we will have half the languages that we have today? Will we lose even more than that? Are we really tracking to do that?
So there are estimates that range between a loss of 30 to 90% of the world's languages within this century. And again, that depends on one hand how you count languages. And also, of course, it's very hard to predict the future. And many languages that are cataloged as endangered language in the UNESCO World Atlas of Endangered Languages or the ethnologue.com. But it's really hard to exactly foresee what's going to happen. Very good indicator that a language is about to be lost is what we talked about, the transmission rate to the child's generation. If children do not speak the language anymore, then the language can get lost within a generation or two. And another indicator is when we see that the domains of use of a language are decreasing. So if before people would speak it, let's say in an African context, at the market and to all the neighbors and at home and maybe in a more regional area, and all of a sudden we see that other languages come in that are used in church or in politics, and so the domains of usage are shrinking constantly, that's also a bad sign, because then people just don't have the opportunity to speak their language anymore if there's nobody left.
So I want to ask all of our guests, what is lost in this? I mean, I think of, because Nadine's talking about, for example, in Africa, where there may be, 500 or 600 languages spoken in, where did you say that?
Oh, that was Nigeria.
In Nigeria.
So in Africa as a whole, we estimate about 2,000 languages.
And you talk about how parents may think, well, what do my kids need, or what do we need to use? I mean, I remember I was, of all places, in the Italian countryside, and I had tried to get as much Italian as I could to be useful for a week there. And I have these two tour guides in the countryside, and it occurs to me 5 minutes in, oh, they don't speak Italian, they speak Piemontese, which is the local dialect. I guess it's a dialect and not a language, technically, I'm guessing. But later in the day, I was told by someone else in Piedmont that, well, most people aren't really doing that anymore because we don't really see a use for it. And I thought, wow, what a strong statement that, you know, that they don't necessarily see a use, and they're definitely not all teaching it to their children anymore. And I thought, okay, well, what's lost here, whether it's there or in Nigeria or in you know, native communities here? What do you think is lost when we lose a language, Nadine?
So I think for the community, in the end, it's going to be probably a loss of a feeling of belonging and identity. And with every language that is being lost, we lose a repository of knowledge, because as we have heard from Robbie, there are just certain parts that you can, or certain expressions, certain feelings that you can only express in that one language. And if you try to translate it into English or a different language, it just doesn't translate. So my native language is German, and there are certain things that I rather say in German, or even in French. So I also studied French, and there are certain things where I feel this is the exact right word for what I mean.
Give me a German word or a phrase, and then try to give me it in English.
Well, the one that comes to mind, of course, is known in English as well, which is Schadenfreude. You guys just don't have a word for that.
No, we don't. We've stolen yours. It's very useful. Very useful.
Yes.
Okay. So that's some of what you see as lost. Ryan, what do you see as lost when we lose language?
Yeah, as significantly is our culture. Especially for Native Americans, there is so much of our traditions and ceremony that's embedded in our language. So, when you lose the language, like I stated earlier in the program, you lose the culture. And that's unfortunately a very present reality once you lose the language. Yeah, so you lose those passing on of traditions and culture and ceremony, you know, when the language is lost.
Robbie Jimerson, what do you think is lost?
It was mentioned before, there's certain things that you can't say. There's certain things that are better said in certain languages. And I just feel, you know, when you speak a different language, it's almost a different way of thinking. I feel like you kind of think, in the language that you're speaking. So I feel, you know, that would be lost. Along with what was just said, a lot of the cultures and stuff that's just all embedded. It's really just one when it comes down to it.
Okay. Maya Abtakian, grab that mic, because I want to talk a little bit about language shift here. But why don't you start by telling me what you think is lost when we lose languages?
Well, I mean, so in addition to what everybody already said, it's not, first of all, it's not the case that you can't have something as a social identity if you don't have the language, but it is closely tied to your social identity. And I also think that, I mean, from my perspective, one of the things that's lost is multilingualism generally, right? I mean, Robbie's talking about, and Nadine talking about, switching between languages, being able to use both, being able to express yourself in both. And I think there's a lot that's lost if we're shifting toward monolingualism.
And so language shift is something that I know you've done some work on. How do you see it happening? How generally, tell me a little bit about the research and the work that you've done on this.
Yeah, so I try to kind of look at it from both perspectives, both individuals and their attitudes toward their language varieties, what kinds of choices they think they're making, and then also from a sort of a more macro perspective, what are the social and political forces, education, what kinds of things are kind of causing them to make those choices?
What What do you think is mainly driving language shift in most communities that are losing it? Is there a general common theme?
One common theme is, I think, really across the world is universal education. And I do think that that's one way. I mean, if you're talking about ways that technology can change things, I think that we are in a position now where it doesn't have to be the case that we have limited resources for educational materials, and so they have to be in a few global languages. I mean, we have more resources. It's easier to do those things more cheaply, to create materials for kids to come in learning in their mother tongue.
Yeah, I mean, John emails the program and says, Evan, the world is more connected. Your guests have been saying that. So shouldn't there be a language or two that everyone can speak? Why do we think that's suddenly a bad thing? Well, that's from John. What would you say to John?
Well, I think this idea that somehow in order to speak the same language, we have to lose the other languages that we speak is actually one of the reasons why languages are being lost.
There is, I think, a mentality, Ronnie, kind of going back to those boarding school stories, that said, well, if the white English speaking teachers would hear students speaking a native language, that, well, they can't be fully focused on English, or that there's something threatening about another language. I think Maya's making an important point there. What would you say to John when he said, hey, shouldn't we want this? Shouldn't we celebrate one or two global languages? We can all talk to each other now.
Yeah. Well, I recognize maybe some of the obvious potential benefit in that. Again, going back to what we had just talked about, there's so much that gets lost when you're not using the language and you're not having an appreciation and a continuation, to teach our younger children and our younger generations the language, because then it gets lost. And again, like I said before, if it's lost, then our ceremonies and our traditions end up getting lost as well, too. So there's such a need. And for us, I mean, as Native Americans, too, it's sacred. There's such a sacredness that we hold to our language because we recognize all that the language holds. So to say, why is it such a big deal to move away from that? That's kind of part of the reason, too.
Yeah, I mean, that's sacredness. Robbie, you were saying earlier, it's not just the language. It's a kind of a way of thinking, maybe a way of communing while speaking the languages. What would you say to our emailer, John, who says, hey, a one or two global languages helps us all talk to each other?
Yeah, I mean, being able to communicate with everybody, that would be a great thing. But I don't think that doesn't necessarily have to happen at the expense of other languages, right? So, we can speak English, but, why can't we speak other languages as well? I feel the whole boarding school thing, there was a different motivation for that, right? So that was specifically to, eradicate the language. So I don't know if those things really go together in that.
Okay. Sasha writes this to say, Evan, I've lived overseas several times, and I've learned five languages other than English. I became fluent in one. However, when you're in other countries, I find the people are often so desperate to learn English that they simply won't talk to you in their language. They make it hard for you to speak their language, and so, yes, it's arrogant to assume that everyone in the world should speak English. But we have to recognize how difficult people in other countries might make it for native English speakers to learn their language and their respect their cultures that way. I only see a little bit of that, Sasha. I've traveled a good amount. I want to respect your experience, Sasha, while also saying what I find is when you travel, when you put in the effort to speak language, most of the time it is received warmly. At least that has been my experience. Nadine, can you grab the mic? What would you say about that?
So I'm on the other end, so I'm the non-native English speaker. I would say that often probably there are also power relations playing into this, and that people start speaking English because they perceive the English culture potentially as the more dominant or the more prestigious culture, and they want to show that they are educated people and they can also speak English, or their English is so good that they feel, oh, it's just easier for this poor person who struggles to speak my language, and I'm just being kind, offering to speak their language. That would be my take on non-English speakers speaking English with an English speaker.
Okay. Ronnie, how do you feel about Sasha's point there? I mean, it's just not been my experience, but I'm trying to respect the point that Sasha has experienced.
Yeah, I mean, myself personally, even my own personal experience, I've traveled overseas once, and that's what I felt too. Like if they knew you spoke English, it was well received, and they wanted to continue because they feel like there's something more that they can learn from you. But yeah, I was very honoring, like, no, to try and make me understand your language in your communication. Yeah.
Okay, well, and I have another email as well from a listener who's was referring to some of these videos that we've seen that have gone viral, taken in places like grocery stores. In this particular case, the woman who emailed is referencing a video that happened, I think, in Denver or a suburb of Denver, in which a white woman approaches two Latina women and is screaming at them to speak English, to respect our culture, to speak English. And happily, somebody else steps in and kind of another white person steps in and says, get out of their face. They've got every right to be here. And unfortunately, we've seen a number of those videos. Does something feel visceral, knowing that all the history, especially with indigenous people in this country? I mean, we're not going to lose Spanish anytime soon. But does something feel visceral when you see that, Ronnie, when you see somebody saying, screaming at somebody in a grocery store to speak English?
Yeah, unfortunately, I mean, it just represents that dominant culture, and really it just has such elements of being colonized and, trying to force that colonization onto other people living in this country, which was very representative of, what happened in boarding schools and what happened with, our 500-year history, with the forced colonization. That happened when, the colonists had landed here and implemented, that as the dominant culture and, kind of forcing everybody else in their path, being Native Americans, to, this is what you have to do.
Yeah. Robbie, any thoughts on that?
It's surprising for me, especially, as I understand it, tolerance was supposed to be one of the principles for the founding of the United States, and then for someone, getting after someone else for speaking a different language that I don't really understand that.
Mm-hmm. Nadine?
So I think, and probably we all agree that it's the language, Spanish language, is not the problem here. So the yelling doesn't happen because of the language, but it's just the language is just a symbol of that other culture. So it's a problem of xenophobia, of racism, mm-hmm. and you could also probably have yelled at immigrants if you come from that background, like it happens a lot in Europe, for instance, for at Muslim women wearing a scarf. So it's these emblematic signs of otherness that xenophobic and racist people do not want to accept, and they just use it as a trigger or as a reason to yell at other people in a very unacceptable way.
Apart, Maya, from just the obvious sort of grossness of that video, I'm sorry to make an editorial comment, but apart from that, is there anything connected to loss of language or the way cultures can sort of bully languages out? Because, again, in this case, we're not going to lose Spanish anytime soon.
Yeah, I mean, we're not likely to lose Spanish because it serves that role in other places, but that doesn't mean that we couldn't lose Spanish here because of similar types of policies here, right? I think, and even it promotes a feeling of insecurity about the use of your own language. We know of cases where, for example, people respond to census questions, and when you ask what's the language you use most of the time, they only list the dominant language in that community, even if they use other languages at home, because of either a fear or an insecurity about listing that language, right? So I think that can happen.
All right, real quick, I'm going to take Jim in Rochester because we're down to our last couple of minutes, but keep it tight, Jim. Go ahead.
My question was, is it possible for them to also offer classes in cooking or lacrosse or other cultural activities that would integrate the language with other things being done, and then draw upon a wider range of people that would become interested, and then also simultaneously learn the language?
Thank you, Jim. So he's talking about sort of context, language in context there. And Robbie, what do you think there? Is there something to that, either in language simultaneously in sport or cooking or something that would tie specifically?
In general, I think the more context you can tie, to learning a language, just the better it'll be. So if you're doing something fun like cooking or playing lacrosse, I definitely think. There's a better chance you'll retain the language that's tied to it.
Okay. Ronnie?
Yeah, I agree, too. I mean, anytime you have an action with, when you're trying to learn something, it just kind of solidifies what the person is learning from a cognitive standpoint. I think anytime you can put those hand in hand, I think for Native Americans, too, in Native American culture, it would just be so natural. That would be a natural part of the process.
Well, again, though, if you want to participate in any of the classes currently available, what do people need to know, Ronnie?
That we have classes at the Native American Cultural Center at 229 Empire Boulevard, and they are Thursday and Sunday evenings from 6 to 7:30, and it is Mohawk. And Mohawk, too, is actually, I just wanted to, put a little plug in for Mohawk, but extra information. It's a very descriptive language. I mean, as many of the Haudenosaunee languages are, but, much like Robbie was saying, too, you can have, there's actually an app that my son and I have on our phones for Mohawk language. And so we'll look up something like ant, for instance, like the insect. And when you look up, how to say that, it's this huge, long phrase that you're saying. And it's because it's so descriptive. And there's such beauty in that and such creativity when you look at the language.
Does your app give you the audio? Pronunciation too?
Yep.
That's great.
So it is. So even, thinking back to, the unfortunate racism that has long been a part of American culture and looking at Native Americans as, savages and they didn't really know anything, but when you really break down our language, it's hard, and it's very complex.
Complex and beautiful. Yeah. I'm glad you spent the hour with us. Thanks again for being here, Ronnie. Always great having you.
Thank you.
That's Ronnie Pollack, also with us from the University of Rochester, Nadine Grimm, Maya Abtakian. Thank you for your expertise. We appreciate having both of you. Our thanks to Robbie Jemerson, and I hope we can continue these conversations and follow your work. Thanks for what you're doing, and thanks for sharing the story with us.
Thanks for having me.
And Caitlin White, thank you for bringing the story to us and for the curiosity of a reporter that got us all thinking about this, frankly, that we should have been thinking about years ago. Thank you.
Absolutely. I'm glad we could grow from 6-minute piece to an hour.
There you go. It's a small start. Our thanks to Fritz, who's our volunteer today. Thank you, Fritz. Rob is the engineer. Megan is the producer. I'm Evan. Have a great afternoon. Talk to you tomorrow.